We've reached Rohatsu, December 8th. Rohatsu means December 8th. That's today. And some people say that that's when Shakyamuni Buddha, after eating some sweet rice porridge, looked up at the morning star and didn't know what it was. And the last 100% of his problems were solved. We have this image on the altar today. You may have seen that seems to be the traditional painting in Japanese Zen temples that is displayed on the altar during Rohatsu Sesshin, usually mounted on a scroll. It's a famous old painting by Liang Kai, Chinese painter. And Andy Ferguson showed us a slide of it for those who were here at his talk, that very painting, because it's very well known. And you know, we'll make our offerings later this afternoon to that Buddha. And it's unusual. When I've seen it there on those altars, I thought, well, of all the images of Buddha's enlightenment, isn't it a strange one? Like, how about the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree with all the you know, demons, Mara, attacking and shooting arrows and everything, and the Buddha sitting serenely and touching the earth? That's a common picture of Buddha's enlightenment. This one's very different. Buddha's usually depicted with a halo, and this one he doesn't have a halo, and he looks very ordinary. And I think it's called, and there's a whole genre of these walking Buddha paintings like this, called Buddha Descending the Mountain. He looks like he's walking down a mountain path. So it's maybe just after his awakening, and he's re-entering the world, looking kind of scruffy, and like he's been in a 7-day sesshin. Just this barefoot, tattered robe guy walking down the mountain from the peak.
More of a cave, really, like on the side of the mountain.
Well,
statues, emaciated.
Yes. There is that place, but interestingly, I don't know about the story. You know, I was actually just in Bodhgaya. You've seen that cave too.
It's like an hour outside.
Yeah, of yeah, and they say that's where Buddha practiced austerities. So it may be that this is referring to some story like that he's coming out of that cave to go to the Bodhi tree, which you know you can see 10 miles down the way from that cave. So the story maybe gets a little confused in China. They didn't really know how the things were laid out in Bodhgaya, because the Bodhi tree is not on a mountain.
No.
But,
well, I heard that he attained his enlightenment and came down into town, Bodhgaya, and hung out for another night or a week or something, a while, and then kind of had this, I should teach kind of moment.
Yeah. Actually, it was like 5 weeks or 7 weeks under different trees, apparently, after his awakening.
The way the rocks are in that picture, mm-hmm. there's a silhouette of somebody sitting from a distance. If your glasses aren't so clear, it looks like somebody's sitting.
Yeah.
And you get up close and a haggard guy walking.
Uh-huh.
I thought it was somebody sitting.
Like from the side view?
Yeah.
Yeah. It also looks kind of like Tassajara Road for people who've seen that, you know, with these very steep cliffs on the side, and then the road, and then steep cliff down.
I think it is Tassajara.
Sometimes we talk about these two aspects of practice, you know, going up the mountain and realizing the way, coming back. With gift bestowing hands into the world, which we'll do at the end of the day today when Sesshin disperses. In one of the secret teachings of Soto Zen, there's images of swastikas, forward and reverse swastikas. Forward meaning, you know, the swastika is like a cross with little tails coming off it, and the tail like the traces, the wake of a turning cross of, you know, that's kind of what the image is like. It's like a turning one way or the other way. So depending which way the tails come off, it's clockwise or counterclockwise. I think actually technically one of them is called a swastika and one of them is called a savastika in Sanskrit. I forget which one is called which. The forward and reverse, but there's this reverse. It's reverse turning. Turning the light of awareness back. and turning away from the usual flow of the world of doing. And that's kind of like going up the mountain to realize the way. And coming down the mountains, like when the swastika turns the other direction, and going along with the way of the world, entering the regular world of everyday life. And so it kind of looks like this picture is like the after many days of reverse swastika turning, the Buddha's swastika stopped and then started turning the other way as he descends the mountain to help beings. The way of the world turning swastika, the clockwise, the regular way, is just harmonizing with everyday world. That might be Thai language instead of Sanskrit, but maybe related. It does sound similar. Swastika. There are, for sure. And remember the hand? There's a koan, I think in the Gateless Barrier. That koan is, how is my hand like the Buddha's hand? Anyway, there's this hand that's, we can check out how it's like the Buddha's hand. And the front side is like the mind of conceptual awareness we're experiencing right now. And the back of the hand is the nature of mind. So there's the mind and the empty nature of mind. They're both clearly aware, but one is sees a world of things out there, and one doesn't see anything, but yet it's clearly aware. The mind and the nature of mind, and like the hand, they're very close and they always go together. So it's like Buddha's now moving from the back of the hand back to the front of the hand, but now the front of the hand is maybe more beneficial in the world because it's completely integrated with the back of the hand after the Buddha no longer understood what the morning star was. And thinking about the images in the Genjo Koan, enlightenment is like the moon reflected in the water. So we have these two sides of the water and the moon. Again, like this hand. The front side is the water. Front of the hand is like the water. Our conceptual mind, our everyday experience. And the back of the hand is like the moon. The moon's reflected in the water. Now this is, maybe gets weird because we're mixing metaphors here. But in the seventh day of the scene, maybe you can see how a hand is like the moon and water. Moon and water reflected right there. The moon does not get wet, nor is the water broken. Right? The front of the hand is not broken by the back of the hand, and the back of the hand doesn't get wet from the front of the hand. Right, these two are like completely together, completely integrated in one hand, but they don't disturb each other. They're completely, each is completely whole, but they're not separate at all. The moon does not get wet, nor is the water broken. Although its light is wide and great, the moon is reflected, even the puddle an inch wide. This back of the hand, this nature of mind, has no boundaries or limits, completely all-pervading, vast moonlight. But the entire vastness of the moonlight is reflected in one dewdrop. Right? So the front of our hand is like our everyday life. It's kind of like that picture of the Buddha. The entire nature of mind, nature of the universe, all as one, all-pervading moonlight is completely contained within that that tired, raggedy guy coming down the mountain. We had an interesting discussion the other day with someone about identity, and like, well, isn't, you know, getting into all these forms of practice, doing all these old traditional Zen things and thinking of ourselves as practitioners, isn't that like kind of building up an identity? The more we do more of this stuff, isn't it actually reinforcing an identity when actually our job is to let go of the identity? But if we see it like this one hand, there's this letting go of the identity as the back, the identity that's never been, never will be, never can be a trace of any fixed identity, anything, even called a person. And yet it's expressed in a particular identity, and in Sashin we really get into it, like the precision of all these forms and this ancient tradition, and yet that the water is of, you know, doing all these particulars and really getting into our identity as Zen practitioners, that water is not broken by the moonlight of identitylessness that's right here in the midst of it. We have to live in some form. We can't escape a personality and a form, and you know it changes all the time, but it's particular. This is each thing abiding in its dharma position, very particular, and yet it's pervaded by this moonlight that equally pervades each particular identity. And the depth of the drop is the height of the moon. I think I mentioned in our Genjo Koan class that that may be my favorite line from the Genjo Koan. Kind of a strange line to be favorite. But that the, you know, you can this dewdrop that you can change its size, it's like looks like me or looks like you, we're all different sizes and particular identities, and but whatever our particular shape is, the moonlight equally fills each dewdrop. And that's how it is, right? If we look at drops and puddles on the ground, it's like the moon doesn't discriminate or isn't smaller in some. I mean, I guess if you look at a small drop, the reflection of the moon would be smaller, but it fills that drop just as it would fill a bigger puddle. You may have to study, you know, some of these reflections when the moon's out. But that's the image, is that the depth of the drop is our uniqueness, our individual personality, and it's our practice. We can look at in a sesshin, our practice every day, our distracted practice, our very concentrated practice, are all different drop depths. But the moonlight is equally filling all of them. Amazing. It equally fills our distracted mind and our concentrated mind, our trusting mind and our doubting mind are equally pervaded by this moonlight. A little bit more on this investigation of turning the light around. Did you notice this morning in the chant, in our Song of the Trusting Mind, it's woven in everywhere. Did anybody notice that? That practice appear in that chant? The line goes, to return to the root is to find the meaning, returning, turning the light back to the root of awareness. But to pursue appearances is to miss the source. So if we're looking outward at appearances, we miss the source. And then the next line is, at the moment of turning the light of awareness around, so literally turning the light around, there is going beyond appearance and emptiness. That's that same meditation instruction. As well as think of what's not thinking, as well as who is this person, as well as what is my original face before my parents were born, as well as who is it carrying this corpse around. These are all the exact same practice and put in different creative ways. And so here's a little exercise. I thought it might be fun to try this experiential exercise in this practice in a very down-to-earth way. And maybe it's so down-to-earth that it won't work for you. But this comes from a teacher called Douglas Harding. Does anyone know him? He wrote a book called On Having No Head. It's very interesting. I think it's the same practice, and he had apparently some deep realization of this, and then tried to put this in, you know, he didn't really know Zen terms or anything. He tried to put this in these very practical exercises. And after Sesshin, if you look at, I think his website's called The Headless Way, you can watch these little videos, and he calls them experiments. To confirm this. And so you have to, I wouldn't try this on the first day of Sesshin, because you have to really have a pretty open mind and just openness to be into this kind of thing. So the experiment is, you're sitting here, and as I've been mentioning with this exercise of turning the light around, it's not about asking these questions about who am I. It's not about coming up with an answer that should be the answer or anything intellectualizing in any way at all. It's directly, what are we experiencing beyond all preconceived ideas? So you start pointing, and you just start pointing at anything. Okay, what's this? And a preconceived idea might be floor. But try to experience it in terms of just color and shape, right? And, you know, just, I'm not saying we have to go into some deep samadhi or anything to do this, just our natural, okay, I can open to this as a kind of beige color, flat surface, and here's a blue angled shape, and we're pointing to these different colors and shapes, and really trying to directly experience what they are. So you can maybe it helps to actually even point. Try point at the floor and perceive what is that? Okay. Now you can point to various different objects I think it helps to point because you can watch your finger and look at, you know, your fingers directing down towards something. And now point to your legs. I'm like, what's that? We might say, well, that's me, that's my legs. But that's just a conceptual idea. It's more already it starts to get weird if we open to the direct experience. They're not exactly my legs, right? They're it's some things down here. Down here. And then you start going this. Now, what's this? Now, so it's my stomach or chest. And now it's, you know, when you look down here, if you look from this perspective, our eyes are usually looking out at the world, it's the whole thing is almost horizontal, right? It's almost your light. You could imagine, if you didn't know you were sitting up, you might think, well, this is actually a field, my front of my body. And then he says there's something like the bottom line, he calls it, where you keep going up like this, and you can't go any further. You can't see your neck, for example. So at some point, you see this thing, and if you really open to this, it's not the front of my body. It's directly experienced. You know, what is it? It's something here, but is it me? And then keep going, and then this. And what's that? And if we say my face, that's just, or me, or my head, or my face, those are all just ideas, because obviously, this is a visual experiment, right? We don't see it. We can't, right? So, what is that? Can you open to actually directly trying to discern what is that? You know, not any ideas about it. But our direct experience of that, it's like there's nothing there, isn't it? You know, at the end of your finger that you're pointing to, what's there? Now, you might see like a little bit of the tip of your nose or something, but maybe come up a little bit to you. And though maybe it's even okay, your nose, but like closer and closer to your eyes. And what do you see? What's actually that? What's your experience of what's here? That's where our, you know, where we're perceiving the world from here. What's there? We immediately remember our face in a that we've seen in a mirror, but our direct experience is not so, right? Can you open to this? Can you? Does this like have some impact on you? To me, first doing this with in a very open-minded way is like, wow, actually. You know, our direct experience is that we actually don't have a head.
For me, it's like right in that field where I can't see, what did you call that, horizontal line or something?
What's the field?
Where it goes from obscene
you see?
Body
mm-hmm.
to...
You can't see it anymore.
Like this blackness, you know, my mind immediately goes to sort of this black field.
Yeah, it's like that. Or it might be a black field, or it might be a really light field, and actually, and then it looks like this. It's like what you know. This is who I am, but it manifests as this. And this is we're using the eyes in this case. We could probably do a similar experiment with the ears and other senses. So it's metaphor, really. It's a visual metaphor for we're talking about actually now awareness, non-visual awareness. Similarly, but that exercise, that's the kind of questioning that's like asking, like when we're asking, who is this? It's like in our direct experience in this moment, and we don't have to have learned anything. That's the beauty of this. We don't need to know any Zen teachings or anything to do this exercise and to ask, who is this? Because it's not about giving like some Buddhist answer. If it's a Buddhist answer, that's not the one. That's just something that we learned, you know. So it's, yeah, it's just a concept. So our direct experience of who is this, we actually can't see anything there. But the beauty of this metaphor is it's not like there's nothing. It's not like we're suddenly like dead. It's like totally alive because here it all is. Or we could say, again, the two sides of the hand. Like pointing back the nature of mind, we can't see anything there at all, but the front that's completely not separate from it, it looks like this. It looks like the entire world.
It seems
my tendency to lose the beginner mind. Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's all about not losing the beginner's mind.
Resistance to this, oh, well, here we are, I'm going to do what he says.
Yeah. Like a child, you have to be really...
There's this resistance.
Exactly.
Like, oh my gosh, am I going to really play this game?
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah,
that's different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
I've
had, like, trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And all these little exercises, experiments that he calls them, Douglas Harding, are all similar things. They're very simple things. Things using a mirror is one of them. And you cutting out little like eye holes in a mask, bringing it closer together, bringing it up to your eyes. I mean, I won't tell you all of them, but they're, you know, if you have a kind of very beginner's mind, like childlike mind, they're actually, I find, really powerful tools, even though they're silly.
Well, there's a sense of like accomplishment.
Yes. That's also kind of like we might, in the what we're calling the third subtle Dharma gate of unsupported tranquility. What an amazing attainment, right? Unsupported tranquility. I don't even need to rely on the breath. I am completely resting in nowness, very still and bright and energetically. How wonderful! Like, why would I want to like destroy this by like asking a question? Like, who is this? Well, that's so extra. That's like, but that's what this. In terms of how we're presenting this stages of meditation, it is kind of like it's renouncing that nowness.
Too, you know, it's like I made it to 10. I mean, I got to do it again.
Yeah,
it's hard to get to
10. Yeah. And it is, and I think there is value in if we make it to this resting in stillness, to really nurture that and really cultivate that. That's a totally valid practice, and yet it's not the whole picture. So this turning around, asking, another example of the story that this might sound different, but I suppose this is the same, is, you know, when Bodhidharma met the emperor, and emperor said, "Who is this facing me?" And Bodhidharma said, "Don't know." Classic Zen story. This is like, I imagine it that Bodhidharma is like really in this meditation mode all the time, or at least at this time he was meeting, and he took the emperor's question as a profound meditation instruction. Who is this facing me? And he's like, boom, okay, we're going to do it. I don't know. Well, he knew that maybe already, that he didn't know. But that's, you know, any answer, that's a kind of a Zen answer now because Bodhidharma said it, doesn't really do, but maybe that's as close as we can say in words when we turn the light around and ask, who is this? Don't know. It's not like we're missing something. That's like maybe the closest thing we can say in words to what is this? It's not nothing and it's not something. Like, I don't know. My knowing mind cannot get a hold of this. Knowing without touching things. So, but to just say, like, before, because we heard that Bodhidharma said that, to say, okay, who is this? I don't know. I can't know. To say that because we heard it doesn't work. And we have to, that's why, as a practice, this is like completely wholehearted, experiential questioning. So like, well, okay, even if I know the answer is going to be, I don't know. Still like, we have to verify, I don't know. We have to confirm that we cannot know what this is. We can't just say, I don't know, and I know that that's what they all say. So like, that's good enough. I believe it. We can verify that we can't know this by continuing. Who is this? Well, I'm starting to go into, like you say, like the darkness. I'm going into this dark space. But maybe is there something more? Who? Is there something beyond this? Keep looking and looking. No. But could there be? Then we, you know, these are the kind of questions we might ask with not so many words. It's hard to talk about this, but that's what this investigation is like. Could there be something beyond this darkness? A little seed of self in here somewhere, and continue to looking. I feel like there might be. Well, but who's that? And who's the source of that? What's the source of every single thought we've ever had, and every single thoughtless awareness? Keep asking until we, like, beyond the shadow of a doubt, we know that we do not know. And that we cannot know. Yes.
The personal histories of people like the Buddha, who were original thinkers, original insiders, have very commonly the experience of total shattering experience. Like, everything they've tried doesn't work.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Somebody gave him some rice, and he goes, "Oh, this is pretty cool." All of a sudden, he's alive again. Now he can think about it. So,
in beginner's mind,
yeah,
at that point.
Yeah, because and I know people have had some experiences like this, and just, you know, boom, done. And then Everything is blown up. Everything I thought I was is blown up.
Mm-hmm.
In your hand, what's this?
Mm-hmm.
That kind of shattered experience. So it brings me to this point. There's a lot of ritual and ceremony that the followers build around all these people. You know, it comes to institutions, all this kind of thing, lovely places like this. It's not the object to give people the opportunity to inflict upon themselves a shattering experience. It's not the shattering experience kind of the seminal condition for this great koan?
For what great koan?
The great koan is, what is this?
Mm.
I mean, my own didn't come by virtue, I tell you that. It was the failure of all my vices that brought me to my particular.
Yeah, giving up, realizing that nothing works.
Yeah. Yeah, what we have here is a virtuous path. So.
Well, the virtuous path is over here.
Well, this is virtuous.
This path, this one's not virtuous, yeah. or unvirtuous.
Yeah. So while we can get all wrapped up in beauty, you know, the aesthetics of this, that's quite beautiful, does it all come down to the butt pain? It is.
I thought the butt pain was part of the beauty.
No, that's the non-virtuous pain.
I can't see my butt pain. I only there. But it comes down to, can I have tolerance for that self-shattering experience at which point I go?
Yeah, I think, and I've been. Well, Kathy, go ahead.
Can I take a shot?
Sure.
It's not that the shattering is. You could have a shattering experience and go psychotic. It's not that the shattering does it. I think it's your response. It's like after the enlightenment, then what? You know, after the shattering, you know, do you run? And I've done this. You know, run screaming away from the source of it. But then, you know, if you live long enough, you find that damn source is following you. You know, and so at some point there's this not turning away quality that, I think there is a moral aspect to virtue, but I think that's a slippery slope that I think a lot of even religious people get into a lot of trouble with, and to me it's more the virtue of being with it, cooking in that pot, sitting with your head on fire, and what is this, you know, then something cracks, something opens, you know.
And so there is an intention to be present to that.
Yeah, that's what I think. That's what my experience
and
is.
And if you're not, you just go crazy.
Well, yeah. And every time I sign up for Sashin, I go through this period of this is stupid. I hate this. I hate Zen. I mean, truly, I do. You know, I really, really do. And yet, you know, something happens. And something shifts, and I, you know, I start not knowing, or something will happen in this machine, you know, especially in this role, and it's so easy, you know, but you know, just get to a place where there's just that the pole, you know, Patrick's 100-foot pole. That inevitably, there's some place where something just has to let go, and then I go, oh, right.
And then the beauty of this container. Of this tradition is that's what we let go into. I mean, at the end, we're going to let go into the vast universe. But the beauty is like, now what? You know, like, who am I now? Oh, it's time to, you know, offer incense or something. Right? So, and I've been just really appreciating that side of the beauty of what we call, you know, our family style. Our house wind, and this is a very traditional Zen center, and I've probably got taken that even further since arriving, but you know, this feels like it could be a sashin in, you know, the heart of Japan and Dogen's time, you know, really the outer appearance of it. And it's beautiful. And I think we taste the beauty of it. I feel like we're tasting the beauty of it in a time like this. And in that, in the ultimate sense, it's got nothing to do with anything at the same time.
Yeah, some of it just, you know, there's that whole thing about having the good fortune of being, of stumbling into, the, you know, it's kind of put that way, that I stumbled into the Dharma and I had the good sense to make something of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of the thing too. If we had just like a dirty warehouse with a dirt floor, and you know, we just like sat any old way, like in the dirt, and like not too many people would come, and it wouldn't. And we just like, you know, when we start extracting all the traditional ritual out, it can become kind of dry. Too sometimes, I think, but something, I mean, it's beyond being able to even talk about, I think, but the way that this, the wind of this particular house is expressed as the way that the ancestors expressed it, it's just amazing to me that it's possible to keep doing this. Yes.
Okay, I like the practice every
time. Okay, go ahead.
But it's not really. It involves the whole other thing involves the military. Those of us who wore a uniform and took it in harm's way absolutely cringed when George Bush landed on the aircraft carrier in his garb, right? There is a cringe factor that happens when people are just wearing the uniform and haven't got the insides. And yet, we don't have to wear the uniform to be able to identify immediately who's been where. There's a sense of that. So there is the emptying into the form, but that experience of emptying has to be actually real from the inside. And not just putting on the forms of being empty. And this is the hazard I think we get into often with great spiritual movements that have turned into religions. It's easy to put on all the vestments and look just like the picture. But there's a cringe factor when you come up against somebody like that. You go, God, this is something not right here.
And you could say that about it, not the spiritual things too, but anything, you know, if you're the checkout person at Walmart and you're wearing, you know, or you're, say you're not the checkout person at Walmart, but you're wearing the Walmart uniform. It's just confusing. Because then the customers will come up and say, like, which aisle is the soap? And you say, I don't know. So... But also, you could see it from the other way around. You're saying, you know, don't go from the. I keep, you know, all in terms of this hand, so we can take care of the front part. And actually, sometimes taking care of the front part, like virtue, for example, helps us open to the back part. And actually, doing the forms of practice, even if we haven't realized, that's what I see. It's like, it's beyond being able to talk about this style of the house that. Not only encourages us through the kind of strict sort of austerity of the form in the sesshin anyway, and yet then there's this other side that I think is more what it's really about, but and just kind of equally valid is that yeah it comes from the back forward. It's like now, like you say, everything shatters and like. We get up and like, now what? And, well, how are we going to express our life now? So like the Buddha, like there he is, right? He's like, I tried all these practices and forms and none of it really worked. It was all kind of like a bunch of experiments that failed. It was all, I didn't really get it. I tried all those practices that other people are doing and then I just saw how it was. And now I'm coming down the mountain and like, how am I going to live? And so he didn't, it wasn't just random. I mean, it was, it's random. I mean, it was just arose due to conditions. He continued to live kind of like he did beforehand. He just took that form in India of the spiritual mendicant. And as he says in some sutras, just because he liked it. He liked it. I think that's another thing about the, in this question about identity, like, why wear these robes and stuff? It's like, well, what if we like to? And if we like, this is, gets dangerous, because if we like to, because then we feel really cool and stuff, and people maybe respect us more. And that's not it. But if we like to, because I just want to express my devotion to the Buddha. And why did the Buddha do that? To express his devotion to simplicity, maybe. And that story that we told with the sixth ancestor, right? He wasn't a monk, or he didn't have a particular form to express. He had this awakening that was in a Zen monastery, but then, and then he said, now what? And his answer to now what was just, let's go just live with the hunters out in the forest for 15 years. Had nothing to do with what looks like Zen practice, but he had that Zen mind, or that no mind. And then eventually he like started wandering. He happened to be wandering by a monastery. Maybe he was trying to avoid it, and they basically like pulled him in and said, come on, put this robe on and like do the Zen thing, because that's how we relate to this kind of stuff. But he didn't need to. It's just how it happened for him. I think that's one of the great stories, to see how he wasn't trying to do anything. Basically, people kind of pushed him into it a little bit. But he was totally flexible, so yeah, okay.
So this goes to Kathy's question, I think, yesterday. You know, we've got this body thing, what do we do with this? And I think your answer was, well, just do it, and it'll make a difference.
The practice?
The practice will make a difference. So you can't really fake it, can you? If you're trying to say this, then it will have an effect, regardless.
What will? Well, everything has an effect. Everything we do has an effect. And it just seems that those things seem to have, at least they're not causing a whole bunch of trouble that we can see. I mean, it's better than going and robbing a bank or something to offer incense to Buddha. At least it seems on the surface. And, you know, we could say more about their effects, but we don't need to. We can just do them and experience their effects. That's what I mean. I think there is some unspoken effect of over and over again attending to these like intricate details of respect and devotion. That's like, which in a way, those respect and devotion like are on the front of the hand, but they but they're part of being alive. If we just have empty nature of mind and go rob the bank because that's just an empty space anyway, then that's not quite it. How do these like total integration of the two sides?
Well, and you were saying that like if this was in or if it was a Zen center in China, it wouldn't have the same politeness as the Japanese.
Yeah. Yeah, we are kind of like Japanese influence, but I think our culture is actually, we have some resonance with that Japanese style, and maybe I've been too long in it to be unbiased in such a statement, but I feel like it's good training for a, we're actually a very casual culture, so I think the more like formal aspects of how Japanese manifest stuff is good sometimes. We don't need to take it to the extremes they do, but it's good training for our very loose form in our culture. It's just a kind of side effect in a way. It's not about shattering all ideas of body and mind, but it's training body-mind training.
Well, in India, it's just like the total spaz, chaos.
Yeah. And that has its value, too. But...
So there was an evolution of Zen or Buddhism. I mean, there has been.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it's evolving in America too, yeah. And how to keep it really authentic and yet not stick to like a Japanese way. I think this is our koan.
I like the minimalist approach that Soto Zen has, as opposed to the Tibetan, which is all very embellished. You know, this it lets me calibrate my own chaos.
I like Rinzai with all the punching.
Yeah.
But I know there's a fifth gate too.
A sixth gate. Yes. Yes. It's time for the sixth gate. So does anybody remember the first five?
Counting.
Purifying. Now, if we want to, all of those ones were verbs with ending with ing, right? So, if we want to keep it in the same grammatical form, we could say purifying. But we could say, because it's the last one, we could just call it purity.
Is this renunciation connection?
Well, they're all renunciation. Each one is like a letting go of something more coarse in the previous one. And this is the final letting go. So, remembering that the realization of turning back is the wisdom of the mind opens forth and develops in a way no longer requiring one to bring to bear additional skillful effort. It carries on in a way allowing one to naturally be able to invoke analyses, turn back towards the origin, and return to the source. This is what's meant by the realization of turning. As for the cultivation of purification, or purifying, or purity, through realizing the purity of the form aggregate, one refrains from generating false thoughts about it and is not coarse in discriminations regarding it. The same is true with respect to feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness, all five skandhas. Realizing the purity of the five skandhas, one puts to rest the defilement of false thinking. This constitutes the cultivation of purification. One also puts to rest the defilement of coursing in discriminations. This too qualifies as the cultivation of purification. One puts to rest the defilement of grasping at a self as well. This is what's intended by the cultivation of purification. To state what is essential, if one is able to bring it about that his mind conforms to its fundamental purity, this qualifies as the cultivation of purification. If one does not ultimately apprehend any subjective entity which is able to cultivate, any objective sphere which is cultivated, or anything which qualifies as either pure or impure, this qualifies as the cultivation of purification. Mind accords with wisdom. Unimpeded, skillful means continuously manifest and abiding in the direct experiencing of samadhi. The mind remains free of any dependence on anything at all. Which is a kind of complicated way of saying just realization of emptiness of the five skandhas and no abiding self. I would say realizing the back side, the nature of mind. The nature of mind is vast emptiness and clarity, clear awareness as emptiness. Clear, aware emptiness, empty, clear awareness. And then a monk asks the Zen teacher Lan Ya, in the 100th case of the Book of Serenity, purity is originally so. How does it suddenly produce mountains, rivers, and the great earth? And Lan Ya answers, purity is originally so. How does it suddenly produce mountains, rivers, and the great earth? The Buddha no longer understood what the morning star was. How did he suddenly walk down the mountain into the world and start talking with people? How are our hands like the Buddha's hand?
Is this also a metaphor for the merging of difference and unity?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Unity and difference. Mm-hmm. Merged in one hand. Mm-hmm.
I've been physically detoxing all week. Just sits. You know, or what? I feel like shaky at times, getting out of the zazen, doing tingling, twitching.
So is that, you mean like purifying? I think there's that kind of purifying, and then this is the purifying that's has no toxicity or detoxicity.
Once pure. Yeah.
But the purity is all pervading from the very beginning, too.
I am not.
Oh, yes, you are. I'm sorry.
This shirt sack is not here.
That's Shirto or one of those ancestors said, it's like finding a jewel in a pile of shit. Not like outside of that. Yeah, it's that it, not even in it, it's a little bit off. It's more like it itself, the very pile. Is totally pure, yeah. That's the backside. The front side is like, we have to detox. or as Suzuki Roshi said, right, you're already completely perfect as you are, and yet you could use some improvement. Yes?
Do you remind me, there's a whole other specific meditation on looking for the self, and where is that in the canon?
That's the same. I think another version of the same thing. Yeah. We have more technical versions.
It's a technical.
Well, I mean, we could say it really simply, but yeah, we're looking for who is this, and the way that the Buddha's maybe favorite way of like setting this up is like giving us a hint of like some places to look, and they're called the five skandhas.
So just investigating each one.
Yeah, like so we could that would be like a little like addendum exercise. Like we could just ask without any other elaborations, who is this? Who is this? But then we could skip some step, or we could maybe speed up the process, or. You know, or slow it down, depending on our dispositions, by asking, who is this? And, like, and now, when we look at our experience, everything in our experience, it's five skandhas. It's form, feeling, perception, formation, consciousness. We can also summarize that as body and mind. So is this body who I am? Well, no, that's not who really who I am. But then mind, and we could even say mind is feelings who I am, not perceptions, maybe, but not, no. You know, karmic formations, all our habits, mental habits. And how about consciousness? Now consciousness, the fifth skandha, that's the one that's really who I am. But then we say, but no, that's the Buddha's radical last step. I am not this consciousness. And that's the shift from resting in nowness, stillness, just awareness, present moment awareness. That's not who I am. Who is the source of this awareness? Right? Who, I think that's a way of talking about the step from unsupported shamatha to vipassana is like the analysis of all five skandhas are not the self, but consciousness, is consciousness the self? It's very similar. And I know it's getting late, but I brought this along, and this is the topic that it's on right now, so I just thought, this issue of dropping off body and mind comes up again and again, and people say, well, is that just like sitting zazen, really still, and just letting go of gross attachment to body and mind, letting go of body and mind? And it is, dropping off body and mind means not grasping the body and mind. The Buddha's first teaching said, what is suffering? It is basically grasping body and mind, the five skandhas. So cessation of suffering is not grasping. But the depth of this, I think this is one of the, this is Keizan Zenji in the transmission of light in the story on Dogen's awakening, which is dropping off body and mind. And he has, I think, a very strict take on this, what this dropping off body and mind is. So in case you, has anybody heard this or read this? Well, then I will read it. people think that there are two kinds of mind. One is mind as thought and discrimination, and this consciousness which discriminates external events. The second is a mind that is still and unmoving and does not know or understand anything. The mind of purity and stillness. And I think in our discussion what he's talking about here, that's the mind of unsupported shamatha. So we think there's the discursive, everyday, busy, distracted mind, and then there's the mind where we're just resting in nowness with very little discursive thought, very still, very present, bright, clear, alert. And we think that's the other, those are the two minds there are. And that one's the one we want to realize, right? This unsupported shamatha. So Keizan says, people do not understand that the second mind of stillness is still not exempt from being the root of discriminating consciousness. This is the hard line. People do not understand that such a mind, the mind that's still and unmoving and doesn't understand anything, this is, sounds like kind of like what we've been talking about. But it's not, in this case, the same as Bodhidharma's not knowing. This mind is still not exempt from being the root of discriminating consciousness. In other words, it's the fifth skandha. It's called consciousness, mental consciousness. You could say that this unsupported tranquility is like resting in the fifth skandha. It's been put that way. But that's not Buddha's awakening. It's just one of the impermanent, dualistic five skandhas of body and mind. And it's almost non-dual. It feels like we're just like totally with our experience. And yet, in this very strict version, there's a slight dualism, or at least it's the root here, as he says. It's the root of discriminating consciousness. The ancients referred to it as this place of unmoving clarity. But do not mistake this for the nature of mind, and abide there. Yes.
You know.
Good point.
It's not it because you're bummed when it's gone.
That's a good point. It's impermanent, and as you might remember, the Six Dharma Gates jury says, that's what he says. That transition from stopping to seeing, he says, this great stillness and wonderful awareness is actually conditioned. It depends on conditions, so it's not reliable. It's not the root. It's not the cessation of birth and death. It's not unconditioned nirvana. And then Keizan says, looking more carefully, mind is actually these three kinds. And he goes into, you know, the sixth, seventh, and eighth consciousness of the Yogacara system, which is pretty wordy for Keizan in here. He's doing a kind of like a Yogacara thing. But he's basically saying, skipping the details, basically consciousness is like the mind which likes and dislikes, affirms and denies, the sixth consciousness. Thought cognizes warm and cold and is aware of pains and tickles. Mind, and this would be like, in this case, like what we call alaya vijnana, does not discern right and wrong, nor is it aware of pain or tickle. It's like a wall or like wood or stone. It can be thought of as truly still. Though you have eyes, you do not see. Though you have ears, you do not hear. Words can't do it justice. Although such a thing is mind, it is the seed of cognition and warmth, coldness, and awareness of pain and tickle. So even this storehouse consciousness is the root of all discriminating mind. In the end, this storehouse consciousness must be dismantled. This is getting pretty advanced now, I admit. But if we think dropping off body and mind of Dogen's awakening is just, you know, letting go of thought for a second. I'm not saying it's not that either, right? But is it this? Learning the way is said to be apart from mind, thought, and consciousness. There is still a wonderful brightness that is eternally unmoving. If you look carefully, you will certainly reach it. So this is this, you know, it's not even a laya vijnana, it's not even the storehouse consciousness, it's not the fifth skanda of mental consciousness, it's a wonderful brightness that is eternally unmoving. This, you know, nature of mind, empty but totally clear and aware. It's inconceivable, by the way, if you're trying to get a grip on the back of mind, on the back of the hand. If you're able to clarify this mind, then no body and mind can be found, no self and others can be involved. Therefore, it is said, drop off body and mind. At this point, if you look intensely, even with 1,000 eyes, there's not an atom of anything called skin, flesh, bones, and marrow, nothing to be discriminated as mind, thought, or consciousness. How can you then be aware of warmth or cold from this side, from the nature of mind? What is there to affirm or deny? What is there to like or dislike? Therefore, it said, when you look, nothing is there. So, when you look, nothing is there. The same point. But deeply verify that nothing is there, and yet everything's here. When Dogen personally experienced this place, he said, body and mind are dropped off. Rujing confirmed this, saying, body and mind have dropped off, and the dropped off body and mind. Finally, he said, dropping off has dropped off. Once you reach this realm, you become like a bottomless bucket like a lacquer bowl with a hole punched in it. No matter how much leaks out, it's never empty. No matter how much is put into it, it's never full. Arriving at this occasion is called the bottom falling out of the bucket, which is a classic Zen. Yeah, you are self-employed and self-receiving. Yeah. You're receiving and employing the self in samadhi, and you're happy to do what anyone would like you to do. And you may or may not get hired. The bottom of the bucket dropping out. If you think that there's a hair of enlightenment or acquisition here, it's not the way. Nice capping sentence. Like, I want that. If you think there's a hair of anything to get there, it's not the way. It's nothing but toying with the spirit. People, experience it thoroughly yourselves. Investigate it fully. And you'll find that there's a body unbound by skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. Though you ultimately try to liberate this body, liberation is not possible. Though you try to abandon it, you cannot. Therefore, in speaking of this place, the ancestors say, when everything is utterly emptied out, there is something that cannot be emptied. This bright clarity of vast emptiness. If you can clarify this thoroughly, you'll never doubt all those venerable teachers in the world or all the Buddhas of past, present, and future. What is this principle? Would you like to hear it? My verse says, that bright and shiny realm has neither inside nor outside. How can there be any body and mind to drop off? That bright, shiny realm has neither inside nor outside. How can there be any body and mind to drop off? I'm thinking about it. I found this old journal from my early days at Tassajara. And
your cave yearning days?
It has some, yeah, some notes from the cave.
Okay. Oh, there it is.
That's me with my like dreadlocks and stuff sitting in the cave. Called Sandstone Hermitage. Yeah, and there's no, and I have all these records of all these Dokusans with my teacher, and picking this up today on the end of Sesshin, I was like awed by like that I wrote all this stuff down. And I should burn it.
Give it to one of us.
Yeah, it has all these Sesshin notes, including like notes like, I'm really not supposed to be writing in Sesshin, but I have to write this down. And, yeah, just seeing the things I was thinking about, which are some of the things that I still think about. And, I was 22 at this one Sesshin, so 18 years ago. One of those early sessions that I think of as one of the really, at the time I remember feeling like, this is the best session. Now, that's another thing that my teacher would often say on the last day of session, is this is the best session ever. And I don't think I've said that at Santa Cruz yet, but this time I actually do feel that this is the best session ever.
For
Yeah. And it's because of you all, actually, and your sincerity and practice and steadily going through this. I know we haven't had a 7-day session here until now, so those 2 extra days are nice to really, you know, appreciate the butt pain. And, but to like steadily be sitting here, many of you all, you know, right through, and people coming and going, wonderful practitioners, all of you, and talking with you, I really feel the sincerity of everybody's practice is so moving to me, and that's why it's the best machine ever. And at the time when I thought that that was the best machine, in 1992 or whenever it was, I remember sitting very, very still and feeling like, and really, like, it was one of the, it was the session where, interesting, I'm not saying there's any correlation necessarily here, but it was maybe of all the ones I think of, it was the one where, like, I am like, this is it. And, like, there are no breaks in this session. Like, I just, right after the meals, I would just go right back to the Zendo and sit. I'm like, we're going to get to the bottom of this. And I was a very, like, gung-ho spirit. And then I remember at some point, not at the very end, but some point along the way, just feeling, oh, there's some ease here. And I went to my teacher, and my memory was, I think, you know, so many different meetings, but I think my memory of this time was, it wasn't in Dokusan, it was like, he was, you know, it was a break, it was during Sesshin still, where he was going to the bath, and he was walking along in the way he does, like, very relaxed, and very, you know, peacefully walking into the bath house. And I just felt like, I can't wait for Dokusan for this. And I just went up and said, excuse me, you know, what if there's a, what if one, you know, tastes a little bit of like freedom in the midst of this total pain, which is kind of like the jewel in the pile of shit. And he said, I think my memory too is he very gently just like turned to me and put his arm around me, which is kind of unusual, and just, you know, walk with me. Let's, we can discuss this. And he said, can anything touch it? And at that question, I was plummeted into deep doubt. Oh, what? And so then I took that back to the Zendo. Can anything touch it? It's, as Hungjer said, it's knowing without touching things, knowing without being touched by things. It's the nature of mind is not affected by anything at all. And I was affected when he asked that question. So, but is there a realm where that nothing touches?